This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a psychologist and family therapist, Dr. Dan Gottlieb has helped many people through some of the most difficult passages of their lives. He's also endured a great deal of physical and emotional pain of his own. Nearly 29 years ago, he was in a car accident that left him with quadriplegia, paralyzed from the chest down. On his first visit to Fresh Air, Dr. Gottlieb, or Dr. Dan as he's often called, described how he became devoted to his work after the accident. He subsequently made a mark in his field not only through his private practice, but through his popular radio show on WHYY Radio in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, his newspaper column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and his books. His new book is called Learning from the Heart, Lessons on Living, Loving, and Listening. Dan, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
Now, the last time you were here, you mentioned that you were part of the first generation with quadriplegia who have lived into their late 50s, thanks to advancements in medical science. So let me just start by asking you, how's your health now?
Not good. There have been some changes over the last two, three years, that have kind of told me that I've turned a page in my life. Quadriplegics, paraplegics are prone to a lot of urinary tract infections. I've always had a lot of urinary tract infections. And 2 years ago, I got one that just wasn't going away for the first time. All the antibiotics wasn't knocking it out. And the urologist said it's not going to go away. So we have to do all sorts of other interventions. I've been fine with that for a couple of years, but I know my days are numbered when the maintenance dose of the antibiotic isn't going to work. And then my heart rate dropped precipitously last summer, and I had to have a pacemaker put in. It was emergency surgery. Ordinarily, having a pacemaker in is no big deal. And within hours after the pacemaker was in, I was having wild, dangerous fluctuations in my blood pressure from 300 over 200 all the way down to, it was as low as 55 over 35 once. And more recently, my muscles have been fatiguing, and we might hear it through the course of the interview, even my intercostal muscles.
Which are those?
Fatigued. It's the ones that help me get my voice out, that force words out of my mouth. And I feel a kind of air hunger sometimes because feel air hunger. And that comes and goes. And 80-90% of the time, I feel fine.
You were saying to me right before we started the interview that you feel like your body's going in one direction and your career is going in the other direction. Can you talk about that a little bit more? To feel like your body is failing you in some fundamental way, but at the same time, your career just keeps, you know, taking off. Your previous book, Letters to Sam, did really well. It's published in 14 languages. You've got a new book that's just come out. You're doing a TV special. I mean, so can you talk about that paradox?
It's almost as though I'm watching a movie here, and it's really an interesting movie. You used language, though, that I disagree with.
Go ahead.
You said my body is failing me. And my language is my body is getting tired. I've got a different relationship with my body over the last 5-10 years. That my body has served me nobly. It has worked very hard, way above and beyond.
Oh, see, I really like what you're saying, because what you're saying is that you're not having an antagonistic relationship with your body. It's like, you know, your body's had a hard time and you're grateful to it for having hung in there and done its best.
Deeply grateful.
It's so easy to get angry with your body anytime something goes wrong. So I appreciate the distinction that you just made.
Yeah, deeply, deeply grateful. And I care for my body like it is a fragile lover that I adore.
Did it take you a while to reach that point of not getting angry with it?
Oh, yeah. After my accident, before my accident, I was a young man, so I was ashamed of it. And after my accident, I hated it. I felt betrayed by my body. And after that, you know, I said that I have to treat my body kindly, but it acts like a terrorist to me. and now I don't feel that way. When something happens, It's the voice of my body's exhaustion. That's how I feel. And I feel great compassion and gratitude for my body.
So getting back to my poorly worded question, mm-hmm. how does it feel to have your body feel increasingly tired while your career is getting bigger?
It depends on what time of day you ask me. If you ask me in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, I'll say terrifying is how it feels. But during the day, it's really interesting. I don't know where it's going to go or what's going to happen. I'm going to ride it as long as I can ride it. I am clear about why I work. I am clear about what my life means to me. And I am clear I am living a meaningful life.
You've had several near-death experiences because of the quadriplegia and related problems of that. Does this feel fundamentally different? I mean, because you've always pulled through.
Yeah, it does feel different. I've had a couple of doctors say that they thought my body was wearing out. My body feels tired. It doesn't feel emergent, what's happening to me. I could live another decade. I certainly hope I do. It doesn't feel emergent, but it does feel like my life is getting smaller. Now, watch, we could turn around a week from now and, you know, I could be fine. But the way I feel now, my body is getting tired.
Yeah, and we talked about this the last time you were on the show, but for people who didn't hear that, just tell us briefly about your accident, like what happened.
I was driving westbound on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, December 20th, 1979, and an 18-wheel truck was driving eastbound, and a wheel broke off the truck, not just a tire, the whole wheel, metal frame and all, and bounced across the turnpike and crushed my car. The last thing I remember seeing was a big black thing in the sky coming down, and seconds later, of course, my life was forever changed. I believe, though, that most of us have been hit by a black thing, that in a millisecond, your life is forever changed. You're no sidewalk under your feet, and you're in free fall. You know, it's a doctor saying, I think it's malignant, or a spouse saying, I don't think I can do this anymore, or a sudden death of someone you love. It's what's happened to me is not unusual at all. Looks different, but at the deepest levels, it's not unusual.
I'm trying to remember whether it's in your book or in one of your recent newspaper columns that you wrote about how in dealing with your own anxiety, and like most of us, you have your share, you, among other things, do meditation.
Yes.
And you describe once a 3-day like meditation retreat. You come home and, you know, that night, 2 a.m, you wake up with this big anxiety attack. Your heart is beating. And you're basically talking to your anxiety, saying, it's been 5 hours since the meditation retreat, and already you're not leaving me alone.
And I devoted 3 full days, full time, to caring for my mind. It gave me 5 hours, not to mention $400 for this damn retreat. And there's the mind agitated. But I want to put that in context for you.
Yeah.
About 6 months ago, a friend of mine was concerned about her 8-year-old son. He watched films of 9/11, and now he was scared all of a sudden of airplanes flying in his window. And they didn't know whether to see, he needs to see a therapist, if something should be done, if she can be, do. And I usually don't see kids that age, but I do it informally over coffee, the three of us talk. And I told him, I heard the story, and I told him, you know, this is an age where we learn about death, where we start thinking about death, and it's pretty scary. I said, some people get over it, and some people don't. I said, I didn't. I said, I was scared to death when I was your age, and my fear was the boogeyman. Boogeyman was under my bed, and I thought if I laid still and didn't even move my eyeballs, the boogeyman wouldn't get me. I said, but I was scared to death every night I went into bed. So this kid looks at me, and he says, so where's the boogeyman now? The boogeyman ever go away? And I've got this deepest, but you can't lie to a kid that age because they'll catch you, you know. So I said, I'll tell you the truth. I said, the boogeyman's still under my bed. I said, but after all these years, boogeyman's old and he can't hurt me anymore. You know, he's been there all, he just doesn't have the strength to hurt me. So he's there. I don't get scared of him. He's like an old buddy after all these years. And that's my relationship to my anxiety. You know, it's there. I don't particularly enjoy it, but I don't know what I'd do without it. Wouldn't be me.
How do you distance yourself from it? Like when you wake up with your heart beating in the middle of a big, you know, anxiety attack, how do you not get totally caught up in the panic?
It's my mind. I just watch. I just watch my mind doing what it does. And because I'm able to watch my mind now, I'm able to use the data from my past.
What do you mean?
Well, the data is every time I've had a panic, it hasn't lasted for the rest of my life. It hasn't been real. It always passes. Another emotion is always there waiting to come right around the corner. So when I'm in the middle of this panic, I'm not suggesting I don't suffer. I suffer the same way, you know, the rest of my neurotic cohorts suffer. But there's a quality of knowingness that I have. There's an observer inside of me that observes with compassion. I feel the same way about my mind that I feel about my body. I feel the same way about me that I feel about my body.
So you're not really angry with your mind for having the anxiety that's leading to the panic?
No, it's my neurotic mind. I mean, it's me. You know, it's me. Meditation is really about paying attention. Enlightenment is simply about shining a light on what is. And the more you pay attention to exactly what you're feeling, rather than try to fix it, the less likely it is to stay for a long time, because you're going to be aware of another feeling coming around the corner.
Do you or have you ever taken, like, anti-anxiety pills or antidepressants? I mean, you're a therapist, so you know your way around these drugs. I'm sure you've had many patients who've been on them, and you've had suggestions about whether they should remain on them or not. When it comes to yourself, do you think that you should get an assist from an anti-anxiety pill when you know that it threatens to get the better of you for a while?
Sure. I've got a history, Terry. I think I might have mentioned it, of clinical depression. And clinical depression is a serious illness of one's brain, and it needs treatment. And I take a low dose of an antidepressant every night, partly to help with insomnia and partly to keep a baseline of antidepressants on board. I think antidepressants are abused. It's of great concern to me. And when they're used appropriately, they're a godsend. You know, we talked about compassion for my body, for my mind. To take these medications is really an act of compassion for your brain. Your brain is suffering when you're depressed. It's in an unhealthy environment. It's being assaulted. And it's an act of compassion for one's brain to get help.
In your new book, Learning from the Heart, or maybe it was in your newspaper column, you tell a story about after your father died and you went to the funeral parlor to give them personal effects to put in the casket with him and to examine, you know, how they'd prepared the body. You noticed that on his head they had put on the prayer cap, the kippah or yarmulke. And you had to think, well, my father wasn't really a believer, so should I ask him to take it off or should I leave it on? Tell us what went through your mind and what you did.
My father was more than a non-believer. He was a passionate atheist, my dad. So I thought, well, should I take it off to respect him? And then I thought, well, what if, you know, who knows and what's it mean? And, you know, maybe there is somebody up there and maybe there's somebody's judgmental, and I had him take it off. I finally decided. I called the funeral director, and all this ruminating took, you know, 5 seconds. So my relationship with my dad was I always crapped around with him. I mean, my sense of humor comes from him. He didn't have a good sense of humor, but he laughed so easily, and I loved to crap around. So I have the funeral director come, and he takes the yarmulke off and takes it in the back. And there my dad and I are alone there, and I look in the casket, and I say, you owe me one for that. First time he didn't laugh. I was half expecting him to.
So you wanted to respect his position as an atheist. Are you a person of a faith? Are you an atheist?
I am a person of faith, and I go to synagogue almost every Friday night, and I don't believe in the God they pray to.
Okay, you can explain that.
No, I can't. I can try. I believe there is something divine in this life, in me, in you. Our most solemn prayer, the Shema, says God is one. And I take that literally. So what does that mean? Well, maybe what it means is when we are one as a people, or even at this moment when we are one, maybe that's God right there at the moment, or the marquee at a church around the corner from my house that says God is love. Well, maybe it's the other way around too. I don't know, but I do believe there's something divine in us, between us, and in this life. And I think my job, my personal beliefs, is that little piece of divinity in me, my job is to know it, to honor it, to grow it best I can every day, every year. I'm not real good at it, but I'm trying.
So will you leave this world thinking that there is something beyond this world?
No.
No.
I will leave this world thinking, damn, I wish I didn't have to leave. I believe that I will live on to the extent that other people carry me with them.
Afterlife is memory.
Yeah. So, you know, probably my grandson, Sam. But, you know, my body, you know, I'll continue after I'm dead. My body will continue what I'm doing now and trying to nurture the world best I can. So I'll nurture, you know, that small area of the environment. I just had a conversation with Sam when I was going through all these.
I should mention, Sam is your autistic grandson to whom you dedicated your previous book. It was called Letters to Sam. And the book was written in the form of letters to him.
Right. And Sam's doing really well.
Good.
By the way, really well. And we have a wonderful relationship, and he torments me about being bald, and I try
very
to
nice.
I try to take it like a man, but I one day I failed, and I explained to him in 6-year-old terms the genetics of baldness, and I told him he was going to have my hairline when he grew up, which he refused to acknowledge. So anyway, when I went through these acute health crises this summer, Sam pulled me aside and he said, Pop, he said, how old am I going to be when you die? It opened up a wonderful discussion about death, and I asked him what it meant to him and what he was worried about. So he said he was scared that he would miss me, that he wouldn't see me again, and I asked him what he thought would happen to me after I died, and he described his version of heaven, the kind we tell kids. And I said, Sam, if I am in heaven, do you think I'll still be loving you up there? And he said, well, sure. And I said, will you still be loving me? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, Sam, do you think you'll be able to feel my love for you? And he said, thought for a long time about that. He said, I think I will, Pop. So I said, So we have that going on. So death isn't going to stop that part. It's not going to stop the love part. It'll stop the visiting part, the seeing part, but it won't stop the love part. And Sam seemed to feel a bit better, and I said to him, Sam, there's one more thing. I said, if you're right, if there is a heaven up there, and if I'm up there, I said, when you get older and you start to lose your hair, I'm going to laugh my ass off at you.
My guest is psychologist and family therapist Dan Gottlieb. A car accident nearly 29 years ago left him paralyzed from the chest down.
You've got a new book called Learning from the Heart, and your previous book, Letters to Sam, which was Letters to Your Autistic Grandson, that did really well. Printed in 14 languages, sold a lot. And you were telling me before the interview started, I didn't know this, that you donated all the royalties to charity. And I'm thinking, like, that's a that's a really generous thing to do. I mean, why did you decide to do that?
Well, I've got to be candid. Part of my thinking comes from my ethnic background. And that says to me, if I was going to keep the money, I wouldn't make any money. And if I'm going to give it away, it's going to make a lot of money.
Oh, so you committed before you knew it would make money. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I did, actually. I did.
Okay.
I think I made it clear. I like my life. I really like it the way it is. I'm very happy with my life. And in terms of money, you know, I can pay my mortgage and I can take myself out to dinner almost whenever I want. I can take a couple vacations a year. So, you know, so what? So what do I need more money for? And there's so many people in this world in so much pain, and so many children are suffering. And, you know, what am I going to do? Buy a couple more suits? You know, it's the best feeling I've ever had, Tari. It's just a wonderful feeling.
Since you've talked about how you fear your body is getting tired and that you've turned a corner, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions about facing a body that you feel is getting tired? Do you get scared of what that means?
No. I might sometimes in the middle of the night, but by and large, no. I feel sad. But when I am living with death, I'm living with life. I'm more alive. When I feel death nearby, I feel life nearby. They go together. And I think to a certain extent, that's true for all of us. I refuse to believe I'm different from anybody else in that regard.
But do you still worry about what the circumstances will be? Because so many people just obsess on that. You know, will I be in pain? Will I be alone? Will I be at home? Will I be in the hospital?
I know all those answers, most of them.
You do?
I don't know about the pain, but I'll be at home. I'll be with a nurse because that's how I live. So all the stuff that most people worry about, I've been there. I've done that. Two stories.
Yeah.
One is, I tell a story about a patient I saw years ago who was obese and had two artificial knees, and he was sitting in a chair in a session. The chair was probably too low, and he labored to get out. And you could see he was working really hard to get out of the chair. And he gets up, and he takes a breath, and he looks down. He says, you know, he said, I probably shouldn't say this, but I look down at you, and I think, thank God I can get up. And I said, well, I shouldn't say this either, but I look at you and I think, thank God I'm not going to have to go through all that when I get older. And I felt the same thing with in Tuesdays with Maury. There was one point early in his disease where he says to Mitch, oh, my God, somebody's going to have to wipe me one day. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, you get used to it. And you get used to stuff. So all of the things that people are afraid of, becoming dependent, winding up in a wheelchair, having an attendant with them full time, I've been there. It's not that bad. You get used to stuff. So, you know, I didn't think much about pain. I really hope that doesn't happen. But I'm not afraid. I'm mostly sad because, for obvious reasons, I love my life so much. I love almost everything about it.
Dan, it's really been great to talk with you.
And you, Terry. I appreciate our time together.
Dr. Dan Gottlieb's new book is called Learning from the Heart. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.